Welcome to From Ohio. I'm your host, Bill Smrek. This episode's guest has a profound ability to take nuanced observations of the weather and turn them into philosophical maxims. His sophomore novel, Jacket Weather, tells the story of his real-life love affair with a woman, June, he had met 26 years hence in the music scene of the 1980s in New York. And he was never really able to shake her until a chance meeting with a mutual friend on a New York City street corner eventually brought the two of them together. Told in seasons and interspersed with dialogue from characters at his local gym, Jacket Weather is bits and pieces of real life hand-sewn into a beautiful patchwork quilt that comforts the reader with the familiar while exposing the magic vulnerabilities that love and living in the moment bring. Author, writer, Mike DeCapiti is from Ohio. I started by asking Mike to tell me a little bit about how he writes and what his process is.
Well, I pretty much wrote this book on the fly. You know, that was my process.
Right.
And that formatting that allows you to just sort of pick up the book and read a few pages without feeling threatened.
Right.
Right? Without feeling like it's much of a commitment.
Yes.
It was the same thing for me in writing the book.
Okay.
You know, I could just sit down and write one little paragraph, you know. Ultimately, I replaced cigarettes with computer solitaire. So, you know, I work on something a little bit, and I play a few hands of solitaire when it gets difficult or threatening or whatever,
yeah.
You know. And anyway, a lot of this book was written in just on scraps of paper, that kind of thing. Or if, you know, I live right around the corner from the gym that I go to, and there's a lot of gym talk in this book. So if I come home from the gym, I just sit down and write a conversation that I just had.
When you wrote this story, Jacket Weather, did you feel like you were just this complete New Yorker telling this story, or is there an element of the story of a guy from Ohio that does become a New Yorker and then has this crazy love affair? Like, how much of it gets filtered back to being from Ohio?
I feel like a New Yorker now, unless I'm with June, and then I just feel like a, you know, like a clown from Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, because June grew up here in Brooklyn.
Right, Canarsie, right?
Canarsie, right. So that is an element of feeling like I have arrived, you know.
Mm-hmm.
the idea that that I'm good enough for June makes me feel like I'm, you know, part of the club.
Right.
It makes me feel like I'm a New Yorker, like
yeah.
An honorary New Yorker, maybe,
right.
Because I'm with June.
Right. You know, we were walking around the neighborhood doing some photographs, and we did a photograph in front of your old building. You started to tell me the story that the building was a bunch of Ohioans over there in Williamsburg. So what's the story with that?
Okay, so my closest friend in Cleveland was a guy named Tony Mamone,
mm-hmm.
who was the bass player in Pere Ubu. And he, Pere Ubu was on a hiatus. I guess they were broken up during the 80s for a while. And
they're from Cleveland,
they're
right?
They're from Cleveland,
right.
Yeah.
That's where you know them from.
Right. It's also where I know June from, but I'll get to that
Ooh,
later.
Ooh, okay. Interesting, all right.
So I... Pere Ubu was broken up. Tony was looking for people to play with, and there just wasn't real. There isn't any way to support yourself as a musician living in Cleveland. Anyway, he got a job up here on a painting crew through a guy who was also on this painting crew, a musician named George Cartwright, who did a tour with David Thomas and Tony. And so
David Thomas being from
David Thomas from Pere Ubu, right. So Tony came up here to work on this painting crew, and then he brought a couple of us up there with him. You know, a guy named Doug Morgan, who was also a musician, used to have a band called Neptune's Car in Cleveland, and he came up and was living with Tony and working on this same painting crew, and then I came up, moved in with Tony.
You all sponsored each other to the new country from Ohio to New York.
Exactly.
Right? Chain immigration.
Right. And in fact, when I got, I mean, this is how it works, right?
Yeah, right.
This is how it works when people move here from Italy, right? They know somebody that has a job, and then everybody winds up in Youngstown, right?
Yeah.
Or whatever.
No, it's so true. All the Slovaks ended up on the, Youngstown.
Exactly.
Struthers and Camel, yeah.
Right. So we, eventually an apartment opened up downstairs at Tony, and I moved down there. And then another guy named Jim Crane came from Cleveland to also work on that crew, lived upstairs. We were all working on this painting crew and living at 158 Grand Street. There might have been somebody else, too, from Cleveland. I can't remember now. Eventually, it was a whole scene, that building, because Doug Morgan and another guy opened a club in the... There was a storefront in that building, and they opened a club called The Bog.
The Bog?
You remember that?
Oh, my God. The Bog was
had two locations.
Now you're blowing my mind, because, wait, when, in the early days when I went to The Bog, it had to have been, like... I want to say like 89, 90. Is that possible?
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it was only there for a little while.
And it was the line of demarcation. Like, I never wanted to go beyond that because on the south side, it was like crack houses and shootings and gangs. And I was like, it was for years. When I tell people about the Sambrook, I go, listen, you know, for the first 10 years I lived here, I really never went beyond Grand. That was the line of demarcation.
It was actually the line of demarcation. I think it's a different... between two police precincts. Anyway, they moved it to our building and at 158 Grand, and that was a great place. I saw Lucinda Williams for the first time at that place.
You're kidding me, at the Bog.
In that little room. Yeah.
So how did your interest in writing get started in Cleveland?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I always wrote. And when I was about 18, somebody suggested to me, a friend of the family suggested to me, that if I wanted to be a writer, I should keep a journal. But so I started keeping this journal, but I wrote it as though I was writing it for publication. And for a year, I kept this, typed up these, I did it on a typewriter, you know. And that book became sort of the template for everything I've written since, because there were alternating conversations with observations of the weather and, you know, very quotidian details and you know, through the windshield is sort of like that too. I just immediately started writing in the form that came natural to me.
What do publishers say about that form? I mean, how does that resonate with readers, that form? Is it hard for them to get? Do they like it? You know, what do editors say about it? It's very unique, and I found it very easy to read.
Well,
but it's unusual. It's unusual.
I don't know what publishers say. I mean, publishers have not responded. I mean, I've had a hard time getting anything published. I had to publish through the windshield myself.
Yeah, I read that.
I think it's very easy to read. I think it's very easy to relate to, right? It sort of moves the way life moves. And its sense of time is similar to how we experience time. Jacket weather, as I was saying, is divided up into months, and I find that to be, true to my experience of time. You know, if I remember something, I remember that it happened in a particular season rather than...
I do the same,
...than what year it happened in, right? I've always had a hard time, you know, getting something published. Even this book, I feel like it's kind of a miracle that it found its way to Yuka Igarashi, who accepted it for Soft Skull. But I don't find that readers have trouble with it. You know, have trouble reading that style. You know.
Now I have to ask you. You started to say that you met June in Cleveland.
No, I didn't meet her in Cleveland. I know her through Tony because when I moved up here, shortly after I moved up here, Perubu got back together, and a woman named Jane Friedman was doing their press.
Okay.
Jane Friedman is this...
The Jane in the story.
Jane in the story, who's this sort of legendary... rock and roll PR person and band manager. She used to manage Patti Smith.
Oh, wow.
She got her start doing rock PR with Woodstock. She did the press for Woodstock.
Okay.
So she's very interesting because she bridges... I mean, she was around in the 60s and she was part of the CBGB scene. She was doing all of that, right?
Wow.
Like, she worked with Hendrix... She did Hendrix's press. And she also was with Patti Smith when Patti Smith recorded Horses at
Electric Lady.
Right. So, anyway, they were doing Paraboo's press, and that's how I met June through Tony.
Oh.
They got to be friends. She and I got to be friends, although never.
Now, you guys first met when you were 26, right?
Yeah.
And this is what you're saying. You were 26 then when you first met
her.
Okay.
Right. In like 1988, let's say. 1987 or 8.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So then I moved away in 1992. I left New York. And at that point, June and I didn't really know anybody in common, so there was no way, there was no one I could even ask about her, although I thought about her sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew one person in common, and that person, her name was Nile. I used to ask her about June on the, you know, infrequently, but over the years. And she never really knew anything to tell me. And then when I moved back, I ran into Nile on the street corner, as is described in
the
book.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how the book starts, actually, with running into Nile. And Nile saying, I just ran into June. Let's have dinner, the three of us. So that's how June and I reconnected.
Okay, so that's my next question. Has June been to Ohio?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and what does she say about it? The girl from Canarsie, the quintessential New Yorker. Just give us a little snapshot, one of your little Polaroids of Jane in Ohio, or June in Ohio.
I mean, when we first got together and I was talking about Ohio, she had known somebody from Ohio. Maybe she had a boyfriend who was from Ohio, and she went with him, home to visit to see the town where he was from. I forget where he was from, but it was somewhere in Amish.
Oh, in the Amish.
It was the Amish country, and that was her impression of Ohio. That was the people drove buggies. now she understands that people drive cars there. And
so we met in Cleveland when at the book reading there. How often do you go back now? Because your father's passed away. How about your mom?
She's still alive.
Oh, she's
in an assisted living facility on Cedar Road in Beechwood. So I go back to see her, three, four times a year.
Hey, listen, we're almost out of time, and it's been so much fun talking to you. But, Mike, I'm going to ask you just to send us off with a quick reading from the book.
One night after work, 40 years ago in Cleveland, I took the rapid transit train downtown a Friday night in early December. That's how I remember it, right after work, in the dark. For some reason, maybe by mistake, I took the train to 25th Street instead of downtown. I was going to the record store, Record Rendezvous, where Jimmy Jones presided. Maybe it was payday, and after mentally paying all my bills and figuring and refiguring my budget for the next 2 weeks, maybe I had an extra 20 to blow. I could usually manage to buy a record or two every couple of weeks. Anyway, I got off the Rapid at this deserted station, this deserted platform across the river from downtown, and it was snowing. I was a little lost, but not completely lost, because I could see the terminal tower across the river through the falling snow. I was just lost enough. And since I had nowhere to be that night and didn't have to work the next day, which opened my imagination or dropped my defenses against it, and since I was accountable to no one, I started walking toward downtown. I must have dared myself to do it. Just walk there. And started walking down the hill toward the river. Not that it was a long walk or anything. It was a challenge to routine, to the idea that I had to get right home or explain myself to anyone or to myself. It was a challenge to established routes. And so I made my way downhill, and then, in the dark, among the weeds, I found an unused road along the river, and I followed it. The snow was falling in big flakes and ticking into the weeds, and through it, I could still see the terminal tower. I was lost, but not too lost, and because it was Friday and payday, I was free, but just free enough to know it. I think of this as the time of Sandinista, the Clash record, but it could have been a year later. I don't remember what I bought at the record store. I don't remember being there. I don't remember downtown or by what bridge I crossed the river. What I remember is walking on a road that wasn't quite a road through tall, dead weeds with the terminal tower visible through the falling snow in the early dark of a Friday in December, having what turns out to have been one of the happiest nights of my life.
That's beautiful. Tell me, what do you think made that so happy for you? And do you still feel it's one of the happiest nights of your life?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I don't know. That's mysterious. You know, it's just we spend so much of our time with a destination in mind that, you know, when you have one of these moments of freedom, they're much fewer and farther between than you think. You know, you only get so many days like that. You only get so many moments like that in a lifetime, where you don't have anywhere to go necessarily, mm-hmm. but you're out and you're, you know, alert to your surroundings, and you know, you just, that's, you know, when happiness has a chance to catch up to you.
Always nice to end on a happy note. So we'll say it's a wrap. And with that, I just want you all to know that I really value and appreciate your interest. If you have a moment, please leave a comment or a review, and be sure to follow us on Instagram at from_Ohio. See you next episode.